The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 354, Mormon Millennialism in the Context of Modern Ecology, or The Second Coming in Me, by Marden J. Clark.
We're grateful that they would do that. Actually, we very much miss the cohort of BYU faculty that used to be at the symposium. They really brought a lot to us, but they're probably is an upside to that, as the BYU people are gone. Some of those of us who are left no longer meet the pejorative term intellectual or even so-called intellectual, and perhaps South Temple will lay off us if we're not really that smart, those of us that are left. But we have these two distinguished scholars to speak to us on an important subject, and it's one that my generation has ignored pretty widely, but I find as a grandfather that I can't get away with totally ignoring the ecology anymore. My grandkids are always telling me don't throw that can out there, and we really ought to be recycling this over here. And so it is with pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Marden Clark, who will deliver his paper, and then the response will be given by Dr. Guy Bishop.
I recognize at the beginning that there are three kinds of people here. Environmental nuts, an anti-environmental nuts, and my wife. She has to be here. It's obligatory. Well, you read. Can you hear? If I stay back here, can you hear? I'll try to. If I want to sink down, I'll get over close so you can. Mormon millennialism in the context of modern ecology, that seemed to me a good scholarly title, and then I get the rest of it, or The Second Coming in Me, and that keeps it a little bit personal. I hope things will soon get so bad the Savior will have to come again and set everything right. We don't really have to worry about that. Jesus will come before it gets too bad. He'll take care of us. I'm not the only one to have heard statements like these coming from the center of the Mormon world, and I'm probably not the only one who has winced. They may catch only a fringe response of our community, but I've heard them often enough to feel little need for documenting. Even if they exaggerate in this form, a milder version probably doesn't. A deep sense that because the second coming is imminent, we don't really have to worry about such problems as deforestation, exhaustion of our mineral and oil reserves, loss of rainforests, air and water pollution, global warming, loss of ozone layer, and even atomic waste or global overpopulation. After all, Earth is destined to receive its paradise cycle glory no matter what we do. Jesus will come and sweep the earth clean and renew it. Though I vividly remember my Boy Scout excursion to the Bingham Copper Mine, neither then nor in a recent visit there with grandsons did the standard lecture, the one that glorifies the operation, describes how many tons of overburden has to be removed, and how many tons of ore has to be processed to get a pound of pure copper. Neither lecture mentions the vast wasteland being created by the dumping of all that waste. But anyone in the valley can see that wasteland slowly but inevitably creeping out to cover much of the Ochre Range and out onto the foothills where homes and a town stood only a few years ago. This essay was set off, though, not by such memories, but by Peter Barnes' book review in that infamous left-wing journal, The Nation, of Paul Hawken, The Ecology of Commerce, A Declaration of Sustainability. The review intrigued me enough that I went out and bought the book. It was anything but a disappointment. Hawken's thesis is simple enough, Because we are destroying the earth and our own future, we have no choice but to convert to an economy that sustains rather than destroys the earth. The book develops a detailed documentation of the destruction and its causes, largely corporate and government irresponsibility in the exploiting of resources and refusal to accept responsibility for the resulting poisonous masses. More important, Hawken develops a proposal to get us out of the mess, make exploitation and polluting so expensive that business and commerce will find it to their own advantage to save the environment rather than destroy it. In fact, there would be no waste in the future, Hawken envisions, mostly because creating waste would be too expensive. In other words, Hawken sees a future as a kind of utopian world in which we would all be living lightly on the earth instead of devouring our natural resources. Even in reading this sentence in Barnes Review, I couldn't help contrasting this vision of our next century in which we ourselves have to be responsible for the earth we live on with the usual Mormon millennial vision, which essentially sees Jesus as saving us and our earth from ourselves. I found myself resisting Hawken at first simply because he sees business as the agent for change. Business and commerce, which are the source of so much of the problem. But maybe there's no way around his logic, that business is now the only agency with the power and the resources to bring about the kind of change needed. I'll come back later to the machinery, that it takes a real leap of faith to see business as such an agent after Hawken's devastating picture of corporate irresponsibility and criminal behavior and resistance to every attempt to legislate production and advertising of cigarettes or to any form of taxes on consumption or energy or to any environmental law yet introduced. By now, the exponentially increasing damage and the long-term threats to life on Earth have been so thoroughly and convincingly documented and from so many angles that any detailed attempt there should be merely tiresome. And yet they move us not, or at least they move us not to serious action or to curtailing our addiction to our cars and airplanes and boats and oil and gas, to wholesale and almost indiscriminate use of pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and all the rest. Any of us who have sat for a hot summer hour in an L.A. or Salt Lake freeway traffic jam, hardly daring to lower the window for fear of the suffocating carbon monoxide, must surely have marveled at the civilization we have developed. The recent earthquake, which paralyzed so much of the L.A. system, underscored the madness. When we think seriously about how completely we have become creatures of the car and about what we might be doing irreparably to our world, we surely must think, at least occasionally, this is crazy. There must be a better way. Somehow we're going to have to find it. Most of us realize, at least in our lucid moments, the problems with our addiction to cars and related machines and armaments. Problems that range all the way from dependence on foreign oil, which leads us into strange foreign wars, to oil slicks with their devastation of plant and animal life, to depletion of reserves that took our sun and earth millions of years to produce, to the poison spewed into the atmosphere and water. But let me sharpen our sensitivity by quick reference to several of the more dramatic and less known examples. Take simply the creation of waste. We're at least vaguely aware that America's 5% of the world's population produces 50% of its solid waste. But one comparison will dramatize the broader problem. Around the Hanford, Washington nuclear weapons facility run by General Electric, enough wastes are stored to cover all of Manhattan with the radioactive lead, I'm quoting, to cover all of Manhattan with a radioactive lake 40 feet deep. Now, I don't suppose that that'd be 40 feet deep of those barrels, but you could pour it into a lake that deep and have all of Manhattan covered. And some of the underground storage tanks were already leaking. Hawken asks Riley, what can it mean to clean up such a facility when a single barrel of some of the stuff has enough poison to wipe out a whole nation? Or take the related question of corporate responsibility. Most of us now know Bhopal, India, through the explosion in the Union Carbide plant there that exposed over 200,000 people to deadly gas. We may even remember the chairman of the board of Union Carbide dramatically announcing that he would spend the rest of his life making up to the people for the suffering and deaths. What we probably don't know is that within weeks, he was saying he had previously overreacted and then sought to limit compensation to the people killed and injured. Or we don't know that most have still received no compensation. Most of us think of General Electric with respect. Yet GE has, quoting again, cheated the Army, Air Force, and Navy on defense contracts. It has been convicted for criminal activities and had its contracts suspended by the Pentagon. It has more Superfund sites for toxic pollution, 47, than any other company in America. Billions will be required to clean up the toxic results of mismanagement, and GE claims to have been unaware of the abuses. Or to cite another kind of ultimate commentary on the system we have developed, look at WMX. I think it's the same one that comes around and hauls away my tin cans and corrugated paper. WMX, you know the ads that they end with, the environment is our business. WMX, I'm quoting, has dumped PCBs in lagoons, mixed PCBs with waste oil and resold it as heating oil, and contaminated groundwater with chemical and nuclear waste. The legal entity and a number of its executives have been convicted of bid rigging, fined for price fixing, fined for conspiracy against trade, fined by the EPA numerous times for numerous violations of environmental laws, and jailed for bribes. All the while, WMX continues to grow nicely, returning a 20% pre-tax profits that have made its top executives rich. It has paid approximately $45 million in fines and settlement costs to resolve litigation in the last 10 years, but these costs can be written off against profits, essentially as a cost of doing business. Perhaps enough of this, except to comment in passing on how much of the world's land and water resources are being reduced to waste by toxic chemicals used as pesticides and fertilizers and then leached from the land by runoff. Quoting, since 1945, we have been losing 108 million acres of productive agricultural land to degradation yearly, a total of 4.85 billion acres worldwide. This United Nations figures. And this says nothing of the cost to health from such uses. Whatever else history will say about our century, it will surely say ours was a century of profligacy. Profligacy in the use and waste of resources, in the use and waste of money, in the use and waste of people in massive and indiscriminate bombings. Hawken, like many others, sees all this as coming to a climax that threatens the very existence of life on our planet. To understand this, we have to think of the Earth as one huge ecosystem made up of countless sub-ecosystems, all of which had worked in some kind of near equilibrium until the twin triumphs of modern technology and the profit system. Time was, and not too long ago, when our system was essentially cyclical. That is, all waste went sooner or later to feed some other organism, which in turn fed some other organism in an endless system of repetition. But modern economy and technology substituted a linear system, that is, a system in which we exploit resources already there, return very little to the system, and assume that somehow technology or faith or something will keep the system going indefinitely. The real threat is not that we do a poor job of recycling, but that we may set in motion or already have set in motion, forces that take on a life of their own and that will lead us finally to what Rachel Carson warned us against, silent spring, or we might say ungreen spring. Put differently, our world of commerce assumes an unending source of materials to be exploited and an infinite expansion of technology to do the exploiting. The world of ecology assumes not only limited but already terrifyingly damaged resources and argues for a return to the natural cyclical system in which we will finally come back to a no-waste economy. As we've all heard so many times, no one has proven that smoking causes cancer. We don't know the effects of ozone depletion. We don't know what we will experience, that we will experience global warming if. We don't know. Hawken argues that this is just the point. If my lungs are black and I'm dying from cancer, it's too late to know that smoking causes cancer. If great holes in the ozone mean that much of the flora and fauna die from radiation exposure, or if our pollutants do cause global warming, when we really find out, our world will be changing irreversibly and irrevocably. Hence Hawkins and other environmentalists' sense of crisis. Before we can know, we could doom the world and ourselves with it. But most of my Mormon friends can't sense any real and immediate danger and tend to call people like me environmental nuts or alarmists, and that phenomenon is what called this essay into being. With other Americans, the hostility or indifference to such concerns comes either from seeing the environment movement as a threat to their immediate jobs and prosperity, or from just not caring. Mormons seem to have a kind of serene confidence or religious faith that everything will turn out all right no matter what we do, the primary attitude that I associate with Mormon millennialism. Hawken calls this attitude the myth of no limits, that through resource extraction and technology, growth is always possible given sufficient capital and will. In other words, there are no inherent limits to further expansion. Even as some corporations are coming to recognize the possibility of limits, this myth, again quoting, is so powerful that it appears to be gaining ground in a reflexive psychological reaction of denial, even as knowledge of the carrying capacity of the earth becomes more evident. This description strikes me as only too accurate a picture of what is happening in America and in Mormondom. The concept of carrying capacity is crucial to Hawken's argument. He documents it as a problem in much detail and argues that we may already have passed the theoretical limit beyond which the system itself will move with built-in momentum toward global destruction. Utahns are familiar with the problem mostly as a question of grazing rights and mud floods along the Wasatch, which I, of course, was very much familiar with as a young man. You people are, most of you, too young to remember anything like that. But the idea of a limited global carrying capacity, we resist with every impulse in us. We usually dismiss it as Malthusian nonsense, especially since humans are the only creatures who could really make the earth exceed its capacity, simply because we use and waste so much of its resources, but also because the rest of nature tends to be self-correcting. Our real concern, of course, stems from our deeply held conviction that it is our religious responsibility to bring as many of God's spirits to earth as we can care for. Though we are finally getting some rather vigorous response to environmental problems from smaller groups and individuals within the church, it is coming mostly from people who can be too easily dismissed as fringe. A recent issue of the Student Review, the very unofficial paper at BYU, was devoted almost wholly to environmental concerns. Even the Daily Universe carries an article or two on occasion, but official church sources are strangely quiet about this, what should surely be a deeply moral and religious concern for a people who sing with the psalmist and believe that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We did have a Relief Society lesson, a visiting teaching lesson last year, But the only major essay I've found in LDS periodicals is by a Protestant minister and was published in Sunstone. Admittedly, we can't trace all of our attitudes about the environment to millennial expectations. But those expectations are so deep in the Mormon psyche, so pervasive in our response to the world and ourselves, our scriptures are so full of them, that it would be utterly impossible they should not affect our attitudes toward our environment. It is, after all, an article of our faith that the earth shall be renewed and receive its paradisiacal glory. And it goes without saying that the Lord will be the agent of such change. So what's the answer to all this? How do we cure a sick environment without killing off the patient? Or without killing off the economy, which does the damage, but which also provides us with the materials that keep us alive and comfortable? The second and slightly whimsical part of my title promises essentially a personal response, but that response is so tied in with Hawkins that I'll have to begin with his. Hawkins' immediate answer is a system of green taxes that would tax waste so heavily, just heavy enough to pay for the total cost to the environment, as well as the cost in depletion of non-renewable resources, that business would be forced by its own need for profits to end waste, to economize in all its operations, to quit polluting, to move to a cyclical economy that uses all its waste. Such a system of taxes would finally change not only the way business works, but the way we all live. We would still drive cars, but with gasoline costing about $4 a gallon, we'd think several times before jumping in the car to go for an ice cream cone. But then we probably wouldn't jump into cars that get 20, 30 miles per gallon, but nearer 100 miles per gallon, simply because industry couldn't sell the gas guzzlers anymore. And this only begins to trace the system of changes that would result. Hawkins' proposal would ultimately end our reliance on fossil fuels, substituting solar and wind and other natural sources of energy. Similarly, green taxes based on total cost would force us away from reliance on chemical fertilizers and pesticides, on clear-cut logging of forests, on ocean fishing with 30-mile dragnets, on dams that destroy the natural habitats of salmon and other fish, and so on through a long list of our violations of nature. The green taxes would go a long way toward solving our environmental problems, but they would need help. Help from, of all sources, ourselves. No matter how I may rail at their irresponsible actions and myopic concentration on short-term profits, the bottom line of corporate America, it prospers simply because I am willing to keep buying the products of such irresponsibility. I and 100 million others like me. And by this mean, I mean that somehow we've got to face the absolute necessity of a fundamental change in values and lifestyle. My wife and I live on the lower level of Provost Foothills. We often hike on the upper levels. Right now, we like to walk around the Rock Canyon Park trails just above the temple. But when we do, we can't avoid looking at all those huge, fancy, ostentatious homes being built northeast of the Provo Temple. I always feel sick at heart. Our own home would appear fancy to many, but alongside these is a humble cottage indeed. We, right in the heart of Mormondom, seem some of the most conspicuous of consumers. Many of those homes couldn't possibly be built for under $1 million, and some for much more. Green taxes on total cost might discourage such profligacy, but only a mighty change of heart could really end it. Recently, PBS was showing the final part of its 1990 series, Race to Save the Planet. I was intrigued to see how closely it came to documenting the same threats, the same building toward global crisis. That's Hawken documents. And as is Hawken, it showed half a dozen examples where communities, nations, and communities of nations have been able to put aside differences and cooperate on specific environment crises. For me, the most dramatic was the cooperation of all the nations surrounding the Mediterranean in a large-scale struggle to save their sea as something more than a vast cesspool it was fast becoming, to recover it as an ecologically sound and living ocean. It can be done. Perhaps the most telling example of hope involves the fade-out of the nuclear generating industry because of the unsolved and maybe unsolvable problem of disposal of the extremely radioactive spent rods and, of course, the dangers of nuclear explosion. The heavy irony is that, as with cigarettes, pesticides, and other poisons, we are exporting the nuclear industry to those who can ultimately at least afford it, Asia and Africa. And we're also financing the exporting. Even without the question of nuclear waste, energy from the sun via voltaic cells, windmills, and other alternative sources is proving far less expensive in long-term projections. Had even a portion of the cost of disposal been figured in from the beginning, nuclear energy could never have competed with other sources. Remember the promise, energy too cheap to meter. Such examples of these, including the Green Belt Movement in Kenya, the cooperation of most of the world's nations in the Conference on Ozone Depletion, the Sundance Conference on the Greenhouse Effect and Global Warming, can give us hope. Hawken points to many more examples of effective action by corporations and communities, including the 3M company, which developed the first integrated intercompany approach to designing out pollution from the manufacturing process, and they saved the company $500 million in 15 years. The Menominee Indians in Wisconsin, who have managed their forests through the years, cutting only what was ready, and have actually increased the available timber supply today. The community of Kalundborg, Norway, where a group of industries and the city got together more or less spontaneously to use one another's waste heat and other wastes in an almost ideal ecological system. A significant list of American companies, Ben & Jerry's, The Body Shop, Walmart, Natural Cotton Colors, and many others, who are promoting ecological sense in their own businesses. It can be done. The system of green taxes would not be easy to impose in America, where businesses opposed every attempt to control pollution and waste. But if we can finally see ourselves and our world as on the edge of environmental destruction, then both industry and individuals should not find such taxes so unpalatable. Not if we recognize that our continuation as a viable country and globe depends on them. I don't want to minimize the pain in making such sweeping changes. But if 3M can save that many millions by making the conversion, that should indicate that the move to a healthy and stable ecology need not mean total disruption. The jobs lost would be more than made up in jobs building and installing solar cells, windmills, and all the rest that would go along with the new system. Ultimately, we should have more jobs and far more resources than if we continue our predatory violations of natural ecology. Mormons should like the distinction Hawken makes between commercial and guardian functions, or moral syndromes, as he calls them. We, the people, through our government, must reassert the guardian function. If business cannot or will not handle the ecological crisis, then we must handle it as guardians by imposing the system of green taxes that will force business and industry to solve it for the sake of their own profits. Hawkins makes most of his argument without reference to deity. My personal vision, of course, does include God. It also includes the second coming. But it includes Hawkins' vision of a sustainable economy and ecology in which we have solved most of the problems both of these entail and are living much simpler and individual and communal lives in harmony with our planet. Yes, I know of all those terrifying pictures from Revelations and elsewhere of the destruction that will usher in the last days. And given the equally terrifying powers of destruction we as people have developed, it's not hard to imagine all of those prophecies being fulfilled not by him, but by our own hands, without any necessary intervention. But, and this in spite of all the scriptural and popular pictures to the contrary, the God and Savior I love and worship are not the gods of destruction and vengeance. They are the loving and sorrowing and suffering parent and first son, elder brother, who sorrow over our sorrows and suffer over our suffering. I cannot therefore read or hear of all that destruction without also hearing the usual qualifying if. If you do not repent, if you do not return to me, if. In other words, my sense of Jesus and God in the millennium puts the responsibility on us. And so does my Mormon sense of what it means to be a free and responsible people. We may not know that the ozone is really being irreparably damaged or that we are moving toward global warming, but neither do we know the time or the place of the second coming, and when we come to know either of these, it may well be too late. I can't resist the nice irony of the contrast between our emphasis on individual initiative, free enterprise, the dignity of work, self-sufficiency, and all the rest, and our looking to the Savior to come and save us from the consequences of our disregard and violation of the very earth He created for us and gave us stewardship over. Yes, He gave us stewardship over it, told us to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, but He didn't give us license to destroy it. Too often we have taken these words as license to destroy, to slash and burn, and then move on when the bare soil lost its fertility, to destroy its forest for the sake only of its logs, to spread poisons on it for the sake of short-term gains in productivity, to destroy its rainforest and leave behind only eroded wastelands, to take rapaciously its mineral and oil and coal resources with almost no consideration of future generations, to make vast radioactive wastelands in the name of national security or profit. We brag that all of this has made us the richest nation on the face of the earth, but the long-term results may actually have made us the most morally impoverished of nations. Stewardship, fruitful, replenish, master, I like that word better than subdue, a new Hebrew translation. Surely all these words imply something far different from waste and destruction and profligacy. To replenish it surely ought to mean not that we destroy its capacity to produce, but that we keep it capable of producing enough and to spare, which is precisely what my vision of the millennium suggests. Our use of Mother Earth's capacity so wisely that we continue to replenish it, that we even increase it so that it continues to yield its bounty indefinitely into whatever future a loving Father and Savior have in store for us. That we share with impoverished people the bounty we have and the knowledge and capacity to increase it. That we export to them not our prodigality nor our rapaciousness, but our Christian concern for their lands and their resources and their suffering and hungering people. I can only be grateful that Hawken provides both a rationale and a ways and means to realize such a vision. If business is the only agency with the money and power to accomplish the change, then it is up to us, exercising our guardian role, to enact the graduating system of virtuous taxes that would finally replace most of the crazy quilt non-system of taxes that make April 15th a synonym for nightmare in America. Wisely enacted, these taxes can make it more profitable for business to conserve than to pollute. I do not want our Savior to have to come to a world pushed to the edge of destruction by His stewards. I don't want Him to come and have to save us from our own follies. I want Him to come to a world where the human rights to unlimited profits and unlimited exploitation and unlimited profligacy are replaced by human rights for all peoples to breathable air and drinkable water and basic health care and unpoisoned ample food. In other words, a world in which we have solved the basic problems, have learned to live in sustainable harmony with nature, and can now concentrate on the real work of the millennium. If all this sounds like a utopian dream, that's just what it is. Except that the dream is realizable, and its realization is necessary to rescue us from the crisis of destruction we are building toward for His earth. I know how much we Mormons hate the idea of new taxes. Even more than most Americans, we complain about even a minimal increase in our gas tax. And I know how wary we are of committing ourselves to helping solve the miseries of India and Africa. Somehow foreign aid has become a dirty expression for us. And yet the logic of the dream seems irrefutable to me. Start with three givens: that we should be self-sufficient, that all peoples are our brothers and sisters, and that we really are our brother's keepers. Then, if my prodigality gets me too deeply in debt personally, should I expect the Savior to come and rescue me from my foolishness? Should we expect him to rescue us when we have despoiled his planet? What Hawkins calls the principle of living off our current income, solar and otherwise, ought to have profound appeal to us Mormons, once we accept the idea that the sun that he placed at the center of our universe is the ultimate source of all our energy or income. We can hardly expect to draw on the stored energy indefinitely without bankrupting our world and future generations. Recently, during one of those lucid moments I sometimes have when I'm suddenly awake at 4 a.m., a fascinating question was running through my mind. Just who will be the wicked who will be burned as stubble at the second coming? And who will be the righteous who will be saved? We usually think of the wicked as the thieves, adulterers, and murderers, and of the righteous as us. But everything we know of Jesus' ministry on earth suggests quite different answers. I keep thinking of all those beggar children who chased us over the streets in India, or in a dozen Mexican and Central American cities, or of the hard-working peasants in China, or of the hundreds of thousands of infants born in Calcutta. They too are his little children who both suffer and are suffered to come unto him. Let them stand for all the meek and humble of the earth, maybe even including our own meek and humble. Of the wicked, I can hardly imagine him sparing any government leader or corporation CEO who helped manufacture wars for political or financial profit. I have trouble imagining almost any heads or directors of our mighty corporations who have manufactured and distributed poisons and nuclear armaments and nerve gases and nicotine, especially those who have exported such things to helpless populations. Could any of these not be included in the stubble? And I even worry about us, we who stand by indifferent to slums and hunger and suffering, even while professing to be his disciples and saints. If we're not part of the stubble, many of us will surely be worthy of being spewed out of his mouth. Whatever, I can hardly think of myself as worthy of him so long as I feel myself isolated from and superior to all those suffering millions in the world. Like it or not, we live in a world where almost any action we take as a nation or a church or even individually will affect profoundly nearly every other nation. We can't manufacture or test nuclear bombs or even destroy them without the shock waves moving throughout the world. We can't even sell nuclear power plants abroad without endangering those populations. More than one statesman in the last decade has called for a new declaration of interdependence, not of independence, but of interdependence. I can accept that as our primary responsibility as a church is to spread the gospel. But that very responsibility tells us just how interdependent we've become. I pray for the time when our missionaries will be able to go openly to our many friends in Qingdao and elsewhere in China. We have much to offer them. But if what we as a nation offer is only more of our profligacy, more of our kind of exploitation of the earth and all that in it is, more of waste and poison and arms, then surely we will have violated our stewardship and their trust. Given the embarrassing projection that a baby born in America today will use more of the resources of the world and contribute more to its waste than 40 born in India, then I can hardly view our Mormon birth rate without real ambivalence. It is but one of the many problems and questions that cloud my vision. But none of them, I think, can really blanket it. We may have trouble selling our country and people on the reality of the impending crisis. We may have even more trouble selling them on the green taxes to solve it. But between Hawken and the PBS series and me, I hope that we here have at least become less comfortable about the crisis and may be ready to do something to guarantee a meaningful ecological future, whether our Savior comes within our time or not. The people of our church and state and nation essentially stood by and let nuclear pollution ruin whole areas of our country and many thousands of our people. Witness the suffering of our St. George victims from fallout from the Nevada test sites. Or let the arms race almost bankrupt us as it did the Soviets. Or let the waste blanket our nation. One of my fondest hopes and prayers right now is that we will find it impossible to stand by again and let the world drift into or be pulled into an ever deeper environmental crisis. We now have both the resources and knowledge to return the world to a livable environment. I want what Hawkins calls the inestimable gift of a future. I want us to be real forces in guaranteeing that future, and I want to do it for the sake of, not in spite of, our belief in the millennium. Oh, that's great.
Well, let me preface my remarks by saying that I'm very happy that I'm not a CEO or a politician, and that I'm proud to be falling to be numbered among people that are considered environmental nuts, as you'll tell from my comments. Since Dr. Clark's paper, short me at least, as a personal essay of sorts, backed by a good amount of known fact, my response will largely be a personal response, also backed by fact. By that I mean that my comments, like his paper, be shaped by my observed impressions of Mormons and the environment. Let me begin by saying that I found Dr. Clark's views on what I will label Mormon environmental thought to be quite instructive. His opening quotes regarding the ecological views of contemporary Mormons, such as, quote, "We don't really have to worry about that. Jesus will come before it gets too bad," or other such comments, though I've never actually heard these in the sacrament meeting, I found them to be to strike a familiar chord with me. I could imagine them being said, though I haven't heard it. And it may well be that, as Dr. Clark theorizes, the rather naive attitudes, my words at least, of Mormons about our endangered environment find their roots in millennial thought. Because it's not hard to agree with the belief or the fear, depending on one's perspective, that the second coming is imminent as a strong motivator. Paul Hawken, whose book, The Ecology of Commerce, seemingly prodded Dr. Clark to venture into this, to his current study, might well be classified, at least in some circles, as quote-unquote radical environmentalism. But as the historian Samuel P. Hayes, who's also an environmental historian, and probably not quite as radical as Dr. Hawken, has observed in his study of the environmental politics of the United States from 1955 to 1985, popular ecologists, which I would assume he means those who whose books have reached vast audiences, things like that, have moved accepted thinking about ecology beyond the long-held scientific interpretations quote, the interaction of living organisms with their physical and biological environment, end quote, and toward the more common use of the word today, which is how I believe heard it used today. Many current environmentalists, like Hawken, tend to be at war with what they perceive as a corrupt, greedy, and greedy society, which has turned a deaf ear toward the tormented screams of nature. And it may be these anguished cries, at least in part, are what leads some, don't feel confident enough about to say most Mormons, at least some Mormons, into the ranks of environmentalists. Uh, But I wonder if all, or even most Latter-day Saints, are even hearing the petitions of a nature. This need of awakening Mormon minds to the environment or to ecology, it seems to me, is one of the best served by Dr. Clark's essay. It is his hope that we, as sons and daughters of God, may have a livable future, quote, for the sake of, and not in spite of, our belief in the millennium. And I hope that came through clearly in his red paper as it did in the written version. Now, for my personal response, let me suggest another possible scenario, which goes hand in hand with what Dr. Clark's told you already, and maybe a little bit beyond it. My perspective comes not from Mormon theology, but from my observation about what is happening throughout Utah and along the Wasatch Front in particular. I am a native of Banff Bountiful, just up the road. Since returning from Southern California about a year ago, I find myself repeatedly horrified when I go to my parents' house in Bountiful, and once more, the extensive development which has occurred in recent years. And right here, I better stop and say that to save perhaps some of you from really coming after me later in the comment session, that I am not anti-growth per se, but I'm concerned about development. I'm very much in favor of controlled development. And that's not what I see happening in Bountiful right now. To use a term of made popular by a philosopher named Thorsten Veblen in the early 20th century, my beloved Bountiful has been swallowed up by conspicuous consumption, a term which I believe is rather self-explanatory. And perhaps the most telling aspect of all this development in Bountiful is the most glaring is happening in the very shadows of the soon-to-open Bountiful Temple. The hillsides are covered by the most opulent homes that one could ever hope to see. And if any of you live there, I'm not picking on you, and I congratulate you for your fine houses. But nevertheless, your houses are doing a great deal of ecological damage. For example, the deer from the foothills above Bountiful, which used to get along happily up in the mountains, have in recent weeks, been coming down to graze on the gardens of the people who live by the temple. Why? Because where they used to eat is now gone. Today, I live in American Fork. And since the church has recently announced plans for a temple below Mount Timpanogos, exactly the same thing is happening in my neighborhood, so to speak, as it happened in Bountiful. I had something I left over there. I was going to show you. There's a newspaper article in the local newspaper. You can hold it up if you want to, or I will. Saying that the city of American Fork plans to give the go-ahead for annexation for building lots north and east of the temple for about 41 building lots in that area. What's happening here, like I say, is the same thing as happened in Bountiful. It's not quite as far advanced yet in American Fork, but it will be soon, I'm sure. So to me, at least, the most Mormon-related aspect of the local ecological crisis is not only an ardent belief in the nearness of the millennium, but a burning desire for what I've chosen to call material display, or to have the good life. Likely this is why, as Dr. Clark states, most of my Mormon friends can't sense any real and immediate danger to the environment around them. Be it millennialism or materialism, they just don't want to see the ecological danger which surrounds them. Let me close my remarks by quoting from a recent book by a geographer named John B. Wright. The book's called Rocky Mountain Divide, which compares ecological or environmental matters in Utah and Colorado. And by the way, Utah comes off on the losing end in the book. But as Dr. Wright says, I quote him, "The isolated Salt Lake Valley was a superb choice by Brigham Young for an expanding colony of land-hungry millennials." A beautiful quote. I thought that fit real nicely with what Dr. Clark was saying and what I wanted to say about the opulent houses and stuff. Now, whether or not we, as Mormons, Utahns, whatever, choose to be conceived or seen, perceived as seen, as land-hungry millennials, or whatever, or wise stewards of land, perhaps, the choice remains the responsibility of all of us. Dr. Clark talks about some about responsibility, and I'd just like to emphasize that, which doesn't say if you live up on the bench of Bountiful or someplace like that, that you sell your homes and move away. You can keep your nice houses, but think about controlling further growth and development and not just sitting around waiting for the millennium, the Lord to come take care of all these things. Thank you.
I think that there's a fascinating kind of evidence just from statistics that if our energies go to teaching people, educating them, getting them better educated, the families, I am sorry to say this, Hardy, but the families tend to get smaller, and they come down to about 2.6 or something per family, where if we get out where either into the out in the country where there is no education, or in India or China, not China, yes, parts of China, the families tend to be big. China now is doing it in the worst of all possible ways. One child per family, and they enforce it in the cities. They can't make it really stick out in the country yet, but they enforce it in the city. But there is a negative correlation between education and size of family.
I wonder, is this going on the tape?
Yes, it is. It is going on the tape, and you should use the mic. Thank you, Dr. Clark, for reminding me.
There's another aspect of this problem that you didn't address. I'd like to hear your comments on that, and that's the Ronald Reagan theory of environment. If you've seen one red tree, you've seen them all. Utah voted for Ronald Reagan, I think, in both elections, a higher percentage than any other state, and I think in this state the majority of the people kind of go along with his theory of environment, too. You have a comment on that?
The only comment I have on it is that my postman asked one day if we were the only Democrats in Northeast Provo. I really do seriously worry about the relationship between our attitudes toward the environment and our real support of Ronald Reagan.
The idea of a sustainable community, a sustainable world, was covered in the environmental conference in Rio de Janeiro, which the United States did not participate in, but which other nations, most European nations, take this very seriously. And there's nothing radical about that at all. It's just America at that particular time was very ultra-conservative, I would say, about environmental issues. And the people just don't understand that yet in America. Germany is experimenting with automobiles that have to be recycled, and the cost of production, or the cost of the sales of the car, will include the cost of recycling the automobile. It makes sense. It's right. And we just have to get to that point. My question is, though, is that the secular humanist countries of the world are taking this very seriously, and the religious countries don't even begin to get a hold of it. What's your response?
I wish I could offer something positive to respond to that. It seems to me only too accurate. Of course, that's the whole purpose of the paper, to suggest that our religious commitment is negatively affecting our commitment to the world that we live in. And part of it, by the way, there is some evidence, too, that the population of the world will probably reach some kind of stability sometime around 2030 or 2040 if we haven't already ruined ourselves with it. But part of that, I think, is Catholic insistence, just as Mormon insistence, on not even birth control for them. And they control a large control in one sense, at least, a large part of the Third World.
Yeah. A couple of comments. One was on the question just asked. Lynn White wrote a very important paper a few years ago, 20 years ago, in fact, now, where he attributes the modern ecological crisis to Christian Judeo thought, saying it's impossible to treat a place appropriately when you think it's not the true home. And in the case of Christianity, the true home is the next life, not this life, and therefore we are mere users on this planet, and what we do isn't particularly important. The second thing I am glad to hear come up here is the issue of population. I don't know what we're going to do about this as Mormons, but we do need to be aware that the most hopeful projections I've ever seen on populations are from UNICEF just last year, which are that we now have just nearly 6 billion people. We have 5.8. The population will double by about 2040. And if everything goes well, we'll taper off by about the year 2060 to 2080 at 11 to 14 billion. And the difference between 11 and 14, of course, is gigantic. But here's the trick, and this is the most interesting thing I think that facing us in the next century. We now are using, human beings are using 40% of the photosynthetic product of the planet. We are either using it directly, or we have diverted it, or we have paved it, or some such issue. 40% of the world's photosynthetic product for 5.6 billion. I don't see how we can possibly divert 80% of the world's population, or excuse me, the world's photosynthetic product for twice that much. So Martin gave a fantastic paper. These are issues that LDS people need to be addressing, and I for one just don't understand why they haven't come to the forefront in the manner in which Dr. Clark should have. Thanks.
Perhaps someone can tell me where it is in the Doctrine and Covenants that the earth is described as groaning because of the impurities that are being poured out upon it. Now, how can we, as members of the church, ignore our own scriptures?
I've got a question for Dr. Rushford. A couple of weeks ago, I believe, last week or so, there was an article in the campus paper, or maybe it was the daily, the local Provo paper, talked about a professor on campus, I believe in mechanical engineering, who had taken a Ford Escort and using, quote, off-the-shelf parts, created or built himself an electric car. And the cost was no more than the cost of the Escort itself. Do you know anything about that?
Was my first home teaching companion when I was a little boy. And so I have to say three things that I agree with him on. One is I agree that there's a need for people to become aware of the costs of the way we live. And much as I dislike Rachel Carson and all her ilk, she has blessed the earth. And I think we need to learn those things. So I'm grateful for things like this, even though I disagree with an awful lot of it. I'm grateful for it. I agree that we ought to have consumers pay the full cost of what we consume. And I also believe that we had not a bailout people who are profligate in economic ways or in other ways. That would do away with the welfare system, which is one of the implications. I would just...
The welfare system for corporations.
That's right. But I think, Martin, the last point I'll make is that you don't realize that there's no such thing... I'm going to be hyperbolic. There's no such thing as General Electric or General Motors or Weyerhaeuser. There's Hardy Red, there's Martin Clark, there's Nick Smith, there's Guy Bishop. There's each one of you. Each one of us have cut down a lot of trees because we choose to live in houses made out of lumber. Each one of us are businesses. Businesses don't survive unless consumers like us go to them and buy their products. So I'm a little concerned about denigrating business.